Welcome to Hello Somebody, a production of the Black Effect Network on iHeartMedia. Before we begin, I want to give some thanks to our team. Thank you, Grace and Co. for our graphics, Pepper Chambers for writing, Angelo Greco and Anna Mesa for managing our social media, Tiffany Hale for everything, Erica England for Patreon support, and our production team at Large Media. That's LARJmedia.com. Also, let me tell you what we have going on over at Patreon. Patreon is like our family, where you can become a member and get access to every episode commercial-free, plus videos of inspiration from yours truly, merchandise deals, and a lot more. Head over to patreon.com/hellosomebody and become a member today. All proceeds from Patreon go to support the production of this podcast. Joining us today on Hello Somebody is award-winning journalist Jamiel Hill. In 2018, she was named Journalist of the Year by the National Association of Black Journalists. She is a cultural critic, cultural icon, and a woman that tells it just like it is, as my grandmother would say. She is the host of the podcast Jamiel Hill is Unbothered. She's also a writer for the Atlantic magazine. Jamiel and I talked about several subjects, including Instruments of the Devil, 3-inch heels. Come on, take a listen. The last time we were together was in LA. It was a beautiful day, beautiful event, and you were the moderator for two amazing people, but in particular, I got a strong bias towards Dr. Angela Davis, whose birthday we just recognized, you know, a couple of days ago. And it was so engaging, the conversation that you were having, and Common. I mean, who could leave out Common? But I'm talking about in terms of icon. He's icon in his own way, but I'm just lifting up Dr. Angela Davis.
No, it's all about Angela Davis. You are wrong.
It gotta always be about Dr. Angela Davis when she in the place. But you did such an amazing job, and that was such a great event. And as I love tennis shoes, and the thing that caught my eye were the really designer, they were colorful tennis shoes that you were wearing with your popping dress. And it was so great to see you. I know that our paths have crossed before. When we were both guests with the amazing one and only, I used to call her the professor, I still do, but Melissa Harris Perry, who is very much missed in that space.
Yeah, it was, I know the shoes you're talking about, which I still have, and they are my favorite. There's some Gucci's.
I was right about the designer
part. You were right about the designer part. You had that dead on. And strangely enough, you know who actually gave me the confidence to start doing that is somebody else who we also just acknowledge for much more sad and tragic reasons, but Kobe Bryant. I did an event with Kobe for BET's award weekend, and they have wrapped an entire conference around that award weekend of development workshops and, you know, a series they call their Genius Talk series, where they sit down usually two sort of notable people together, have an interview, a conversation before an audience, and people get to learn things about somebody notable that maybe they hadn't known before. And Kobe agreed to do one with me. And this was maybe a year before he retired. And I was in the green room with him, and I had two pairs of heels that I was thinking about wearing with this dress that I had. And I was asking my girls and my assistant as well, like, which pair should I wear? And Kobe chimed in, and he just said, I think you should keep the tennis shoes on. And it was I was wearing a green dress, and I had some green and white Chuck Taylors, Michigan State, because I went to Michigan State. So they were green and white Michigan State Chuck Taylors. And he's like, no, I think you should be comfortable and keep on those shoes. He was like, just my opinion. I mean, you are Kobe Bryant. Who am I to diminish your opinion? So that was the first time I ever did that. And it kind of became a little bit of a thing. I don't do it all the time, but when I do it, I have the confidence to do it. And because of the company that we were in and Dr. Angela Davis and Common, I was like, you know what? I think these Gucci's would go perfectly with this dress. So
and they did.
Yeah.
They did. Yeah, what a great, incredible story. Miss Kobe. And I definitely understand what you're saying about the tennis shoes, because we were just kind of socialized that, especially if you're wearing a dress, you must wear heels. And it's kind of hard doing the work that you were doing in the sports world. And for me, politics is a sport of sorts as well. And, you know, being on the campaign trail for a presidential election twice, the second time around, I really learned that if a sister want to preserve her feet and her back, it is not wise, because you are on the move. It is not wise to wear pumps. And so kind of similarly, not having necessarily a Kobe Bryant say, I think you should keep those shoes on. But just a similar experience through knowing that if you're on the move, you got to have on some shoes that help you do the job that you were assigned to do at the time. So I, too, wear a lot of Chuck Taylors with the wedges, and there's all kinds of popping. You know, we have what our foremothers didn't have, Jamil. They didn't have all these nice choices in tennis shoes that are fashionable and also flats that are pretty. And we are living at a time where we do have that kind of we have that kind of choice. And also it's hip and cool and chic, and women are really just coming into their own in many ways. And I think the ability to say, I don't have to wear a 3-inch heel is liberating.
You're not lying, man. Cause I tell you, some of these heels, I'm convinced most of them were invented by men to
torture us.
That's really it. Like, I love some, like Christian Louboutins. I love some of those, but yeah. I really can wear very few of them because it's such a narrow shoe. And that heel is just, who would do this to themselves, you know, and why? But sometimes, look, I guess like a lot of women, when there is that choice of comfort or cuteness.
Comfort over cute.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. Sometimes right. I just had to stun on them. I gotta choose cute. I paid for this dearly, but right. I gotta choose it. Probably the worst experience I've had with that was this would have been, I think it was 2015. It was the first time I've been invited to the White House. It was under the former president. You know, they throw those holiday parties. You know, they throw those holiday parties.
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah, yep, right. So I got invited to one. I don't know who drew the short straw and got to put me on an invite. But going to the White House, I'd never been. I wanted to look my best. It was very cold in D.C. at that point. And so I had on like a really nice like blue dress, but I had these blue Jimmy Choos. And I was just like, these Jimmy Choos have an expiration on them. I got like an hour tops before my feet totally rebel against me, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, I spent most of that hour in the security line and trying to get in. And I was not only freezing, but my feet were, that's the most pain my feet have ever felt in my whole life. But I thugged it out. I was like, you know what? Oh, I'm gonna get this. They're gonna get this look. They're going to get this look in this White House. This is going to happen, right? Especially when you go through the greeting line and everything. So there I was, you know, taking the picture with the former president and first lady. And that smile on my face, I have in this photo, I'm not convinced it's a smile. It might have been a wince, because I was like, I'm dying in these.
In pain.
And by the time I left, I was just like, forget it, man. I took them shoes off. Like, not even kidding. I walked barefoot outside of the White House because I was like, I can't take it anymore.
Now, I got a burning question about the shoes. Did you ever wear them again?
Have not worn them since. They are, but I won't get rid of these instruments of the devil, because I have, you know, it's associated with a fond, you know, memory. I also haven't worn that dress either since then either, but they are in my closet. I have a rack of, Jimmy Choo shoes. I have like three pair of which, quite honestly, I'm pretty sure that would be good instruments if people wanted to ever use this to get them to tell people secrets. Because if you force anybody to wear any of these shoes for longer than 10 minutes, they giving it up. They snitching. They snitching. Like, there's no way. I have like three pairs of these shoes. They're all on the same row in my closet. And I have just termed that row the don't ever wear again row. And so they are up there.
I love it. Speaking of killer shoes and instruments of the devil, I wasn't going to go here so quickly.
No, go here. Let's do it.
However, you eulogized Trump. the presidency, the everything. And so what motivated you to take the time to do that and to put that, to really put that out there in the way that you did? It was so creative the way that you did that. And will we ever quite have closure? And where do we go from here as a nation?
So the reason, I'll start with the first part of your question. I chose to do it because I want to mentally be able to turn the page. I don't think we have been able or will be able anytime soon to turn the page as a nation, because I think there's a lot of people, and you have witnessed this firsthand, who just assumed that Trumpism and the element that he brought to the party was an anomaly. When it's like, this is just who the Republicans and conservatives have always been. He was just Biff from Back to the Future. That's the difference. He just wasn't polite about it, right? Mm-hmm. But we've had more polite versions of what Donald Trump was before. His name was Ronald Reagan, okay?
Yeah.
And so the thing is, though, I feel as if, given all that we had experienced for the last 4 years, all the incompetence, the bullying, the bigotry, the racism, the misogyny, all those things, I know I can't necessarily put it completely in the rear view, because that element that he stoked, if you will, or that he brought out in a more bolder form, is just going to be something that we have to contend with for a while. But with him now being banished from pretty much every social media platform, I mean, who gets banished from Pinterest? I mean, like, I was like, golly. Donald Trump. I'm like, so my man can't even share, like, a cute cutting board. Like, it's just not even going to happen. No new curtains, like, no decor. Like, he can't share none of that. Like, no, you just go on.
No, Jamil, he got to go old-fashioned, just standing out on the corner with the real board. You know, the little poster boards.
Right.
That's the best he can do.
He got to go old school, right?
Old
school. So it's like, you know, with him now not having that daily mouthpiece to be able to get out whatever idiotic thing he wants to say in the moment, it's been really mentally refreshing for me personally, as someone who has been a subject of his Twitter attacks. And it just felt like I also wanted to do it ceremoniously, because in many ways that incident, I don't define my career this way, but it became a defining moment. And
sure.
I do not want that to be the first line in my obituary, is that this was the sports journalist that he once attacked on Twitter and there was a back and forth and all that, because then I have done something really wrong if that is the case, right? So that was sort of the thought process with the eulogy. Now, in terms of where we stand as a country, and look, I have never loved anything as much as the Republicans love Donald Trump, ever in life. And I never want to know that love. If that's what love looks like, I don't want to know what that is ever in life. And regardless of whatever wrongdoing, whatever incompetency, they are still very much attached to this man. And I have to say, I shouldn't have been surprised, but I am a little surprised that they have still remained dug in. And I get that it's a larger political play that they're trying to use. It's like they don't want him, but they want his supporters, right?
And so 74 million of them, right?
Yes,
voted for him.
They want that 74 million to stay engaged, stay in play, and stay connected to the Republican Party. And no matter of hypocrisy, shamelessness, or indecency to them is too much to bear to continue that connection. But I guess I am a little surprised that it has kind of gone as far as it has. But all that being said, you know, Trump very much for this country is going to be like a really bad, abusive ex-boyfriend. I mean, that is not going to let this country go and thrive and be in other relationships and be happy. You're going to keep popping up outside the window. And
we will
keep,
be like, stalked for a long time.
We will be stalked for a long time. Now, some of it is because a lot of it has to do with the fact that this party now that has been fully overtaken by him and his presence, they won't quit him. And so the rest of us, as a result, will be subjected to versions of him and people still carrying out his bidding. And that's unfortunate, because this is why this whole idea of unity, while it sounds great and it's a good message, and the one thing I am endlessly impressed with some politicians is their ability to still maintain a level of faith and positivity with this system. But unity is not going to be possible, because without any accountability, there can't be any unity. Like, that just can't happen. And so And those same, the party that Joe Biden is used to working with throughout his, you know, multi-decade career, this ain't the same party. And so I don't know. I understand this is something he has to say and probably something he deeply believes. But just all those little old buddy-buddy friendships that he had with some of the people across the aisle, I just don't really see how that functions under, you know, under a government in which there was a pretty significant percentage of lawmakers who were trying to basically kill the other half. And I do mean that literally. So I, where we go from here is I think we're just going to probably stay in the depths and the abyss of this for a while. We're kind of stuck in this moment of discord for a minute. And it's not going to be pretty digging out of it, because there's 70 something million people that don't want this to get anywhere, that don't frankly want unity. So I guess I just don't foresee any in the foreseeable future.
In eulogizing him, is that a reflection on us as a nation? I mean, I know that Mr. Trump, many people believe, including myself, is that he was a manifestation of something deeper, some deep unfinished business in this country. And I often think that he had to be dealt with. Like, you have to reveal that the way he comported himself as president, you just can't let that go and turn a blind eye. There's a however to it. I think some people in this country take pleasure in pointing the fingers at him so that as a nation, we don't have to deal with the deeper issues of race and anti-blackness and poverty and a system gone wild even before Mr. Trump took the oath of office. So in eulogizing him, are you really eulogizing the system that allowed him to become president of the United States of America? And do the rest of us bear some collective responsibility for that?
I think he got too much credit, frankly. You know, people, much like people tried to act like racism was over with Barack Obama, people yes. acted like racism started with Donald Trump.
Colorblind society, baby. Yeah, exactly. Colorblind.
Yes, post-racial. That was the
post-racial.
Term.
Post-racial. Yes.
Post-racial, right? So racism, Donald Trump did not create it. He certainly stoked it. He certainly brought it fuller, brought it out to more open view. He took the politeness off of it, if
he
you
did.
Will. But I think it was Ta-Nehisi Coates who wrote a tremendous essay for The Atlantic, where I'm a contributing writer, so people can accuse me of being biased. But the question that he posed in this was one that I don't think we're still ready to deal with, is how did he even get here? That's right. The question. The question,
exactly,
like, he's gone. It. He's left the White House. That's fine. And who knows what will become of the rest of his life. But the reason that he got in there, the reason why this is so appetizing and why the stain he left on the White House and the democracy will remain, is because of what is in our foundation as a nation, what's
That's
baked
right.
underneath the skin. So I was always very hesitant to give Donald Trump that credit of being somebody who you know, brought this new form of racism that we had never seen. No, we have literally seen this before. That's why it was so easy to predict. If we look into history and take into account, you know, Reconstruction, all these there were plenty of other points in American history that showed us that this was not only possible, it was inevitable. And so in that respect, while I was burying and eulogizing the man, The poison of white supremacy is just more potent and alive than ever, because now it's been normalized in a totally different way than maybe what we've sort of seen before. You know, the fact that we're having conversations about should there be punishment for the people who tried to storm the Capitol and try to overthrow the democracy, and if they had it their way, kidnap and/or assassinate lawmakers. Right.
Yes.
Like, that could have been so much worse. It said it was by the thinnest of margins that it wasn't. And it's the same with the election of Joe Biden. By the thinnest of margins, he
Very
became
much,
the president, right?
That's exactly right. And that point that you're making is something that I really very much want people to understand. There's not a mandate here. We have unfinished business in this country that is easy to point the finger at the tiki torch carrying folks or the people who wear the white sheet. Meanwhile, we let people with blue suits over white sheets get away. People who are more palatable with their anti-blackness or their white supremacy or all the other isms that really destroy the lifeblood and spirit of this nation. And so for me, that's really what I want us to get at, that deep work that is going to be necessary to really transform this country. And it doesn't always manifest itself the way a Trump did, or the colored water fountain and the white water fountain. Our real work, and I think one of our biggest fears as a nation, is dealing with the systems that were created on purpose to have blacks treated a certain way, like second class citizens, or our brown sisters and brothers and poor people, because this is a caste and class system that we continue to bump up against. And its original sin, anti-blackness, you know, an enslavement of our ancestors, and then what happened to our indigenous sisters and brothers. And we have made some progress, but my God, we still have a long way to go. I mean, it's reminding me of something that Brother James Baldwin said when, you know, he was asked to wait or to be paid. You know, he said, how long must I wait? Or be patient. I forget the exact words. He's more eloquent than I. But, you know, he just started to enumerate. You know, you ask my grandmother, you ask my father, you ask my mother, how long do you want me to wait or to be patient? And so that is my question. I'm in your eulogy of Mr. Trump and the Trumpism that brought him here, and the swirling of that energy, because that was an energy and it's still there. You're right. Even though he's out of the White House, it's still there. I wonder, do we have the courage as a nation, I mean collective nation, to deal with that unfinished business that will always, I hate to say always, I just don't believe in my lifetime that we're going to deal with it in a way that I could assure my son or my grandchildren that they don't have to go through another iteration of what we've gone through, in the same iteration that our foremothers, and even not even foremothers and fathers, because we got our elders are still alive who actually lived that. A lot of times we talk about these subjects, it's not, we ain't got to go too far back. So, yeah, what I mean, do you think we will get there?
My lifetime, your lifetime, no. I mean, and I know that sounds like really pessimistic, because the thing is, you, even though you know you won't get there, much like our foremothers and fathers did, they knew they weren't going to get there, but they still tried tirelessly anyway. Like, they did it anyway. Like, Martin Luther King Jr. told us, I'm not going to get there with you, right? He told us that. He said it in his speech. And so I think what we can do is we can lay the foundation, and we can, or lay a new foundation. We can crumble some bricks. We can break some systems. We can disrupt. We can dismantle some things. We can, excuse my language, we said we can tear some shit up about it, so that they are dealing with a little bit less of this than what we have to. Because even though we're not close to being there, the fact is the generation before us, you know, my mother's generation and our grandparents' generation, they tore up enough of it. So there are certain elements we don't actually have to deal with anymore, right? Sure. So we're hoping it lessens degree by painful degree for this generation that's coming behind us. I just hope we don't take an intellectually lazy approach as we've taken with solving these problems and breaking these systems that have been, you know, tools of oppression and instruments of systemic racism for a long time, and thinking that it will die out. You know, my favorite is when people say, like, oh, the younger generation is going to be different. I'm sorry, when I was looking at Charlottesville, you know what I saw? Not a lot of old people out there. A lot of young people.
True. That's right.
A lot of young people were out there. And especially
Dylan Roof. I mean, he was
Dylan Roof. Young guy, right? Okay.
And so very young. Yes.
When you especially think about how technology is now interwoven and how this white supremacy is spreading on a global basis, and how it's organizing and maneuvering and manipulating systems, that these are things that appeal to young people. And so they are being radicalized through information, through disinformation and misinformation and grievance in a way that previous generations have not. And that's an entirely different element to deal with.
It is.
When you can look at the footage from the Capitol riot and see people who are, you know, very proud and true, you know, canine conspiracy theorists, and the fact that you have elected officials that support this nonsense that are in, you know, that are in the Capitol now, that are influencing laws and decisions and on committees is crazy to me. But, you know, that's a part of the new fight and the new challenge that we had. There's going to be a lot of discouraging moments along the way. And it was funny because when the election results became final for maybe the 55th time, a lot of people kept talking about being happy. I haven't experienced, I mean, maybe the most joyous moment I had was watching the inauguration and seeing former First Lady Michelle Obama come through with the hair and that whole look. That was probably, yes. And Amanda Gorman, like, those are my bits of joy in that. But this overwhelming sense of, yay, we did it, I ain't got to that yet because I'm like, we haven't really done anything.
What have we done?
I was like, we took a baby step. And right. That was more, you know, I think directed at getting the vermin about the White House than anything else. But just the damage of the last 4 years combined with the other hundreds of years of damage. I mean, it's a long road. And if you think about it in its totality, sometimes it can be quite daunting. So we just got to take this thing one day at a time.
One day at a time. No, I agree with you. And I feel like you do. Just the, I don't want to take COVID, you know, people just trying to find something to celebrate. So when I say this, I am not dismissing how people find their joy. I just hope that we, the collective, we understand that there's a lot of work for us to do. And you can't put all of your hopes and dreams into one person, into one system, that it is incumbent upon all of us to be, as Mahatma Gandhi once said, the change that we want to see in the world. And even if you like a politician, you have to make a demand. And the bar is so low, Jamil. I'm not trying to be funny here, but Jesus,
no, it really is.
Being a little better than President Trump doesn't move me. I mean, it just doesn't, because that doesn't get us a whole lot. We need, Dr. Angela Davis, I believe, said radical just means getting at the root. And we need to get at the root of a lot of stuff in this country, politically, socially, economically, environmentally, at the root. And we cannot be afraid to do that. And as long as the fingers are still pointed only at Trump, and rightfully they should be, we also have to do some other things that is bigger than Trump. Was in power. I mean, the man, I think he derives superpowers from all of the fixation about him.
Yeah.
He aged everybody else because he enjoyed getting all of the attention, and he did really get that. And hell, we giving him attention right here, so we gonna move on
from him as I lose my earpiece. I want to ask, so let's talk about change agents in sports. I mean, that is your area of expertise. ESPN, I mean, you have broken so much ground. The daughter of Detroit, the state of North, baby, because, you know, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, so we side-eye y'all, especially at football time.
Oh, man. Well, then it used to be at one point basketball, right? But I love Cleveland. I have very fond memories of Cleveland. I interned at the Plank Dealer. Yeah, so I lived in Cleveland for 4 months. Yeah, I loved it. God. Yeah, yes. I loved it. Cleveland Heights, loved it. Right off Cedar.
Oh, my God. You got to come back. So much has changed. I did not know you did that.
Yeah, I know a little, I guess, old school Cleveland. I know about Hot Sauce Williams and Vails. Vails was the spot.
Vails was the spot. It's all gone, Jamil. It's gone. Hot Sauce Williams is gone. You know, when I drive down the streets of my community and I just really just shake my head and feel a sense of loss, because so many of those black businesses that you're talking about right now, they don't even exist. And even in thinking about COVID right now, 41% of black businesses have gone out of business. And that's not to say other people, you know, our other sisters and brothers are not suffering. It's always disproportionately the African-American community. Think about that. 41% of our businesses have gone out of businesses. Those are and Hot Sauce Williams and Bales has nothing to do with it. But since you brought them up, they've been long closed. It's right. Just an example that those businesses employed our neighbors. They employed people down the street. They were a gathering place and they don't exist. Again, Vails and House House Williams. No, I'm just using them as an example. Yeah. That was long before then. And man, oh my God, we got so much work to do. So changing advocates in from a sports lens, Muhammad Ali, Jackie Robinson. Oh my God, fill in the person. What do you believe the role, is there a role for athletes to play in social change?
It's a huge role. I mean, it's an established tradition in our community, in our culture, period. And I think we've always looked to people who were able to get to that point of, I wouldn't say necessarily, maybe acceptance isn't the right word, but who are able to get a different platform, a bigger platform, more money. We've always looked to these leaders in our community to speak for those of us who did not have the same access to some of the same things that they did. And so there's clearly in athletics, there's been this tradition that was established. If you want to go Jack Johnson and Muhammad Ali, as you pointed out, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, Muhammad Ali, a number of athletes have served in this capacity. And for a while, I think when I first got into sports, I mean, I've been a professional sports writer now, a professional sports journalist, rather, for 22 years, I think it is. And so when Yeah, I'm older than I look.
Oh, Lord. But you started when you were 12?
I was 21 when I started, right? So so when I got into the business, we were talking about late 90s, right? And the professional athlete of the moment that was beloved internationally was Michael Jordan. And Michael Jordan had a much different blueprint for success. And his blueprint was stay neutral, don't say anything political, yeah. Make this money, become a global star. That was his way of doing things. Now, I have been very critical of Michael Jordan and his lack of action, especially while he was playing. But I'll say this, is that in hindsight, which is always good, you know, to go back and reflect, is Michael Jordan's advocacy, his activism was actually in teaching black athletes how they could be major conglomerates. And for him to be a black man, to be the face of Nike, you know, to take that this corporation into multi-billion dollar success is a huge accomplishment. And he taught other athletes how to do the same thing. Sure, I certainly wish he would have been far more politically active, especially yes. in North Carolina, where Jesse Helms was the senator yes. that represented his home state. And Michael Jordan did not back the black candidate that yeah. ran against Jesse Helms or, you know, therefore involve himself in trying to get this man about the Senate. Not saying it would have been easy, but still. All that being said is that I think because a lot of black athletes were focused on the capitalism portion of their lives, that they were very dormant and very hesitant through much of the 90s, even stretching into the 2000s, to never say anything about these issues. You got it in small pockets or in different ways, but in terms of speaking up on social injustice, racism, all these things, that was a non-starter, right? And so what happened, I mean, I think it's two athletes that frankly changed that conversation very strongly, LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick. And
yes.
with LeBron, I go back to when he was with the Miami Heat and they wore the hoodies because of Trayvon Martin.
Trayvon.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so that became a league-wide thing that happened on social media. It happened as all these different teams, they were players taking pictures of themselves in a hoodie and talking about Trayvon because they could relate to either having relate to Trayvon, having feeling like they were him, or the fact that we're talking about a lot of rich black athletes who have children who live in good neighborhoods.
That's
and
right.
if their children are walking down the street and people don't know that's LeBron's child or they don't
Come
know
on.
That's Steph Curry's child or whatever, then who knows what might happen to them if the police right. are called or if some citizen decides that they're someplace that they don't belong. So they very much could relate to that. That opened something, that started something, that sparked something. And then after that, you had obviously Michael Brown and Philando Castile and the women in the WNBA who before Colin Kaepernick took a knee, the Minnesota Lynx, Maya Moore, all those athletes there, they spoke out about that. And the Minneapolis Police Department walked off their post at their games.
I remember that.
Right, because yep. they were so disgusted that these women decided to not only speak out, they had a media blackout. where they were not talking about anything but Philando Castile and police brutality. And fast forward into Colin Kaepernick and how his career was taken from him because he peacefully protested racial injustice. So the athletes of the moment that it became to emulate were athletes who actually had something to say, actually athletes who were willing to risk something to speak out, to talk about injustice and politics and get involved. And because LeBron James is who he has influenced a generation of athletes to do the same. Same thing with Colin Kaepernick. They have so much respect for what he has done. And for that matter, see how easy it is for something to be taken from you,
right,
based off, you know, your beliefs. It's inspired a different level. What we saw the culmination of that in 2020 with LeBron James's More Than a Vote campaign, with the WNBA players. They won Georgia. They helped to win Georgia.
They did.
Because Reverend Raphael Warnock was polling at 9% when those women decided to put on T-shirts and talk about supporting him over Kelly Loeffler. The owner of the team. Now, yes. We already know female athletes, they don't make nearly as much as men.
No.
A lot more to lose, right?
Yes.
And I think it was the most politically courageous thing I've seen done in sports in 2020, is them deciding to defy their own ownership, support her opponent, and just basically give her a middle finger all the way up out of the Senate. And yes, that, considering how little they can afford to lose, that takes some courage, okay?
So
what you saw in 2020, from, you know, the NBA with the work stoppage after Jacob Blake, to so many players being involved on the streets in protest and all the different things and conversations they were having, that is the culmination of what LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick and WNBA players have been able to create during this time of where they see what happens when they don't speak up, and they see just the change and how they can really alter history by using their platform to do something for their own communities.
And we need them. I mean, they certainly have been able to make money quicker and deeper and in more ways than even their predecessors. So in that way, I mean, they can cement a financial legacy that is not that they won't be sacrificing anything, but just because they can get the money, they make the money because of the technology that we have and the type of sponsorships they can get. Even more than Muhammad Ali or Arthur Ashe or Jackie Robinson, others that really put a lot on the line. And so you're right, it's so refreshing. And I hope that our sisters in the WNBA get the credit that they deserve through documentary, through books being written, because you're absolutely right. Their proximity to the owner of their team, it did take a tremendous amount of courage. And they, as far as I'm concerned, are displaying the same courage as like muscle memory of Black women that have gone before them. And some of those Black women are still very much alive today. So shout out to our sisters there. So you, I wanna like end with you. So you, your podcast, you're on Vice TV, which are the little pretty cards. I love when y'all rocking the cards and asking the questions and just doing the thing. What inspires you to continue to push? You've not been without your hurdles, the ups and downs and turnarounds that everybody goes through. But sometimes when we look at people like you or even me or other people that folks may say they made it, what motivates you? What inspires you even in moments where things are not pleasant? And what would you say to your 12-year-old self about who you are today?
Oh, you put 12. I'd probably say stop brooding so much. My goodness. I had a teenager. I was moody and brooding all the time. And it's just like, what? I had a journal that I was writing all my thoughts into, and just ridiculous. But at any rate, you know, I would say this. I think your motivation changes in different stages of your career. I think when you're younger, when I was 16, 17 years old, my goal was to just make $50,000. I was like, if I could make $50,000 a year,
I made it, baby.
I'd have made it, boy. It's like, I'm doing it. You know, that was like my benchmark, of course. And I wanted to, at that time, because for a sports journalist, it was definitely the place to write. I wanted to be a writer for Sports Illustrated. Like, that was my dream. I wanted to write cover stories for Sports Illustrated. I never thought about ESPN. It's like, being on TV was so lame to me. I was like, who wants to do that? That's so stupid. Like, right? That was my thought process then. But as I got deeper in my career and seeing the trends in the industry, it just became, once I got to ESPN, kind of a natural gravitation. So it was very succinct, professional, you know, purely selfish goals that motivated me through, I think, most of my 20s, which is not unlike how it is for most people in their 20s. But when I got in my 30s, I mean, things started to change a little bit because I became a sports columnist. I got into commentary, using my voice, finding my voice, leveraging my voice. And it, much more important things came out of that. It's like I wanted to change narratives about how not only how Black athletes were covered, but how they were discussed and the stories that were told about them, and that there was this huge oasis of stories that could be written about sports and where it intersected with politics, gender, race, and culture. Those are very messy intersections, and sports often struggles to cover these things because sports fans, I get it that sports is entertainment for a lot of people. They want to turn it into a game. They want to escape, right? They don't want to think about serious issues happening in our country. The problem is sports is not happening in one universe and the rest of the world in the other. They're in the same universe, okay? They're in the same place. And sports is not immune to many of the systemic racial issues that are run rampant in our country. Sports is just presented with moments in which it could be a leader in these areas. And because the one thing, and you asked me what keeps me motivated, part of the reason I will always, even, you know, I speak more now about, you know, politics and other issues, but I will always keep firm footing in sports because it's the one thing we still do together in this country. We don't worship together. True. We don't, you know, a lot of us, we eat with the same people. We're very segregated as a society. But sports is not that way. You know, there could be a lot of crazy, hateful things coming on in the country. Tell you what, the Olympics start. We all root for all the American teams, right? Yeah. You know, and even the Super Bowls. Super Bowls watched by 120 million people. It's 120 million people that have something to talk about. They've all watched the same thing, right? And so it has this way of bringing us together, which is, I think, why athletes that have chosen to use their platform to speak out have found and discovered that they've been able to reach people in a different way. You might not listen to what Joe Biden has to say about this issue, but you might listen to LeBron James because he's your favorite athlete, right? You know, they may not listen to you, Nina, about a particular issue, but they might listen to Candace Parker, right? Because they love her and they enjoy watching her play. And so I always thought that was something very powerful and something as a journalist that I wanted to chronicle and be in on. The other motivation I have at this point in my career I've been able to do some really great things. I was at a major network for, you know, 12 years, had a great career there. I was telling you my White House stories. I got to meet some really cool people along the way, from, you know, the president to, you know, Donald Glover to a whole bunch of other people, like, right, that I've been able to hang out with and, you know, talk to and pick their brains about things. That's all cool. That's great. Those are awesome. But at this point, I don't want to just open the door for other Black women. I got to get in the door and change the room, right? Because this has to be, you know, we talked about opening the door and then, you know, sort of wedging our foot to keep it open for other people. I don't have to wedge if I change the room, right? So that door will remain open. And that's why one of the things that I'm really looking forward to is this podcast network that I'm building on Spotify for Black women, right? It's about being Black women, being the talent on the podcast, and about subject matter and content that is related to us. That does not mean other women can't listen, because it's all relatable in some way. But as you know, Black women in particular, despite in many cases, I mean, throughout history, this is just what we've done, is we have always been community minded. You don't ever hear Black women talk about going to the polls and voting in self-interest. We don't ever do that.
No,
like,
we don't.
We don't do that, right? And then whenever our default mechanism is to care and put everybody else ahead of ourselves, and it's led to people, while I realize that they're trying to, you know, be praiseworthy and be respectful by saying Black girl magic and, you know, strong Black woman, but it's also imprisoning us in a trope, right? Mm-hmm. And making us invisible to some degree. That's not magic. That's years of hard work, of sweat equity, of hardened, tough, difficult situations, having to navigate them when you're trying to deal with both the twin combatants of racism and sexism. That's what that is, okay? That ain't magic, all right? That's work, all right? Right. So I think we need a platform and a place where we can talk about the nuanced issues, or talk about them in a nuanced ways, the issues that we deal with, and not just always traumatic issues. We need space to be free and joyous and happy and whatever emotion comes to mind. And, you know, we need a platform because we are invisible still in so many ways. Like, it's all great if y'all big up at Stacey Abrams today. I need y'all to care about Stacey Abrams 6 months from now, or I needed y'all to care about her 7 years ago. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's like, this is sort of my very small way of giving us a space that we have earned above and beyond, you know, whatever standard is out there. And so that we don't, we can fight against this invisibility that we're ultimately pushed into at various points once we've given our all for the greater good of everybody else.
Say that. I am so proud. Oh my God, award-winning journalist. I see that Emmy behind
see
you.
See it back here? You see it?
Yes, I see it. Award-winning, wearing the stilettos and thugging it out, as she says, because they going to see these shoes and this beautiful dress, bringing the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, being uniquely who you are, having valley moments like everybody else, and then mountaintop moments, and in these moments, using your power and that Black girl magic that came by work, because it wasn't just given to us. We had to work, sweat, cry, everything else to get it. And here you are opening doors for other women. I am so excited about your network. Thank you for being with us. We're on the Black Effect Network. And to see you doing what you're doing, and then people like Charlamagne the God, same kind of vision. Like, how do we elevate Black voices? And the majority of the shows on his network are Black women and people like him and Michael Render, you know, AKA Killer Mike, just to have so many of our brothers in those kinds of spaces with a determination. They're showing through their actions how they feel about Black women and elevating us and putting and helping to use even some of the maleness that they have. Not always a privilege, but in certain instances it is, to really lift Black women. And then here we got sisters doing it for themselves. So good luck to you. Congratulations. And when is the debut of your network?
We still, you know, got some I's to dot and T's to cross, but I will let you know for sure.
Please
Y'all won't miss it. Trust me. Y'all will not miss it, but
we
I'm
do
excited
not
want to
miss
it.
Well, much love to you and big ups in everything that you do, and thank you for using your gifts and your skills and your abilities, and you writing in that journal, in that diary. That was a preview.
Look at that.
Come on now. That was your brooding 12-year-old self was in training.
Yeah,
but
I guess
this
it was.
Very moment. So you are such a blessing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the time.
Hello Somebody is a production of iHeartRadio and the Black Effect Network. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.